The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're starting off in the wellness section, and the article is entitled Naomi Watts on Menopause and Her Struggle to Get Pregnant. Both struggles with early menopause and infertility had me drenched in sweat, confusion, and shame, writes the award-winning actress in her new book, Dare I Say It. And this article is by Naomi Watts. Every woman has a story of how she realized that menopause had come for her. For me, the close-to-menopause news came at the same time as the you-probably-won't-get-naturally-pregnant news. I entered menopause and motherhood at more or less the same time, becoming in one fell swoop both mother and crone. And both struggles with early menopause and infertility had me drenched in sweat, confusion, and shame. I always dreamed I'd be a young mother, but never got around to it. Then I found a partner who wanted to be a parent, too. Within 3 months, Leave and I had made the decision to start a family. I'd spent my entire adult life up to that point trying to avoid pregnancy. And so once I felt ready, at age 36, I assumed I'd get pregnant on my first go, maybe my second or third at most. Months went by. Nothing. When I saw the doctor to find out why I wasn't getting pregnant and been told I was nearing menopause, I coursed with shame. What use am I if I can't bear children? Did I become an old lady without even noticing? How could I have let this happen? What have I done wrong? I flashed back to every time I'd ever done something I knew was bad for me. Every crash diet, being on birth control for 15 years. My body doesn't work because I abused it, I thought. Of course it won't let me have a baby because I'm not fit to be a mother. How does guilt and shame send you into such dark places and to beliefs you would never normally consider? It's almost as if that is the self-sabotaging you think you deserve. When in doubt, blame everything on yourself. Even though Leave and I had been nothing but supportive, I was scared to tell him. I was gaslighting myself. I thought if he wants a family and I can't have babies, he won't want me anymore. I felt that when I was told I was close to menopause, I'd been branded an unproductive, barren person. The shame bled into all parts of my life, because I wasn't being completely upfront about this perhaps futile pursuit to get pregnant, which was taking up every spare moment and part of my brain. But I pulled myself together and tried to focus on not being menopausal. And as much as possible, I avoided talking about it with Leave or anyone else. I enlisted his help when I needed to, but I took it on mostly as my job to figure it out. Deep down, I believed this natural course of events could be altered on my own. With enough hard work, I'd have to prove my worth in my career and in finding the right partner. Before things happened, I'd made it clear how badly I wanted them. So why should my fertility be any different? If it was my fault for ending up in this predicament, then surely I had the power to get myself out. Yes, I know that's stupid. In retrospect, if someone said anything like that to me, I'd tell her, we are much more than our fertility. There are plenty of ways to have a family. If you feel you can't share something like this with your partner, maybe the relationship isn't on a solid footing. But at the time, some negative, regressive part of me thought, well, isn't that part of women's worth? Aren't we here to reproduce? Because of my hormone levels, I wasn't a candidate for IVF. But I tried fertility drugs like Clomid and procedures like intrauterine insemination, IUI. I would have eaten my dog's toenails if someone told me it would help. I tracked my ovulation and checked my temperature on the regular. I even got scans to see the follicles and the eggs forming, and we'd have sex at the exact optimal moment for conception. None of it worked. I was peeing on sticks constantly, both to track my ovulation and to check for pregnancy, if my period was even an hour late. I was monitoring the pH of my vagina because I'd heard that sperm do better in an alkaline environment than an acidic one. I spent so much money, but I would have mortgaged my house to try to solve this problem. I became disheartened by the whole fertility process. I began looking into adoption, and I researched donor eggs as well. There was a brief moment when I thought my partner's sperm might have been to blame, but nope, the tests showed he was fine. Then I had one pregnancy. I thought, this is it! I turned back the tide! I did the impossible! Less than 2 months later, I miscarried. I came to learn that, according to the Mayo Clinic, at age 35, the miscarriage risk is about 1 in 5. At age 40, the risk is 33% to 40%. At age 55, it's a 57% to 80%. Another few months went by and nothing. The sperm and the egg were still not working together. And by this point, as a couple, we were losing steam. My obsession created a strain on our relationship. I was driving myself crazy, and the derangement was spreading. We were at the brink of giving up on pregnancy, and maybe each other. What's more, I was perplexed by how ill-prepared I was for my new perimenopausal reality. How confusing it could be! One article I've since read about perimenopause described period durations month to month as having all the regularity of a locker combination, more likely to be 29, 45, 17 than 28, 28, 28. Why had my doctors not prepared me for this? Periods start, then they stop. Period. It's all part of the plan. It's not a failing. Why is it shrouded in secrecy? And even when you own up to it, why is it so confusing? It wasn't until I was trying to get pregnant that I learned that technically menopause is a single day when you've gone one full year since your last period. This happens on average at the age of 51, and that for years leading up to menopause, in the phase now known as perimenopause. You can experience a host of symptoms connected with declining estrogen. Night sweats, unpredictable periods, mood swings, and weight gain being among the most common. I was only now understanding that my irregular periods and night sweats had actually been perimenopausal symptoms, and their cause was not the stress of my overnight shooting schedule or an extra glass of wine with dinner, as my doctors has previously indicated. In the midst of my fertility crisis, I left to shoot the thriller Eastern Promises in London. A few weeks into the filming, I began to feel strange, and I went to a pharmacy. I can still picture it, and bought a British pregnancy test. In my rented house, I stared at the test and saw the faintest line appear. Then slowly it got stronger, until it was a full, clear, solid line. Undeniable. The line was yelling at me, I'm here! I called Lee and told him, Wow, well, let's see, he said. He sounded cautious but thrilled, and I was beside myself with joy, though also afraid I'd lose this pregnancy too. It didn't help that I had to ride a 300-pound Russian motorbike on that movie. The director, David Cronenberg, adored motorbikes and was enthusiastic about me being the real rider. I'd ridden a Vespa before, but this was a monster compared to that. I was up for the challenge. After 3 or 4 motorbike lessons, I could ride around with seeming confidence. then park in front of the camera, take my helmet off, and shake out my hair. I tried to make it look effortless, but meanwhile, all that was running through my head during those scenes was terrified thoughts. Oh my God, this is so dangerous. I don't want to lose this baby. I cannot lose this baby. I didn't want to tell anyone yet because it was so early and because I didn't want to be difficult, so I just kept going. It was yet another example of how, as women, we often do things that put us at risk in order to be team players. A few weeks later, while I was doing a scene with Sinead Cusack, I felt the first flutter. It was a sensation I'd never had in my life, but I knew instantly what it meant. The baby was moving around. The baby was real. The baby was fighting and strong. My eyes welled with tears. The scene was not sad. Crying made no sense in that moment, so it was good that the camera was focused on Sinead. She stayed professional and made it through as if nothing was amiss. But after the take, she said, "What happened? Are you okay?" I leaned over and whispered to her, "I'm pregnant, and I think I just felt the baby move for the first time." Then I burst into tears. "Oh, God, love, love, love," she said, cooing over me and holding me while I wept. I'm sure everyone on the set was baffled, but we stood like that for a long time. So the book that accompanies this article is Dare I Say It? Everything I Wish I'd Known About Menopause. And it's by Naomi Watts. It's $20 at Amazon and $20 at Walmart. Parts of this article were edited due to time. Over in Culture and News, what Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy means today. Reginald Dwayne Betts went from being a 16-year-old facing a 9-year prison sentence to a MacArthur genius, an award-winning author, and a non-profit founder. Dr. King's legacy taught him that no person or nation is beyond redemption. And this article is by Reginald Dwayne Betts. The first time the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. rocked me was when I was a 16-year-old sleeping on the top bunk of a prison cell in the Southampton Correctional Center. It was MLK Day, the only company I had for the 23 hours we spent in the cell on most days was public radio. And that entire day was about the civil rights movement and the life of Dr. King. I wept listening to the radio, realizing, maybe for the first time, how fundamentally and profoundly I'd wasted my life. I thought I'd become my father. I was in prison for carjacking someone with a gun, and I'd committed the crimes a month after my 16th birthday. As a teenage boy in prison, I understood in ways that have long haunted me that I'd ruined my life by picking up a pistol and violence. And yet, I must believe I did not ruin my life. The legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is profoundly one of mercy and forgiveness. His philosophy of nonviolence is cognizable by people across faith and cultural traditions and is still singularly his own. In that, while the long history of black folks in this country has been rife with turmoil and sorrow, Dr. King pulled from the well of joy that black folks invented to get through the suffering. And what did he pull from that deep well? A vision of the world that rejected vengeance, a world that imagined unity. And Dr. King spoke from the vantage point of the oppressed, because he was one of us in every footstep across Alabama or Mississippi or bridge in the nation's capital that he crossed. Why does it matter? I think of anti-colonial theorist Franz Fanon's warning about the oppressed in their freedom becoming the new oppressor. In rejecting the desire for vengeance, Dr. King allowed me to imagine I may be forgiven. From that time, I was a young father, not long after my 8-year bid. To this day, when my oldest son has grown past the age I was when I went to prison, the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. has continuously humbled me, but in the best way. He not only reminds us that there is more work to do, but inspires me that this is work I might do. I am my mother's only child, and she watched me go to prison as a 16-year-old. She has also witnessed me securing the release of 5 of the men I did time with. And each time, the argument was, we are more than we have been. Truth be told, my father is the first person I heard use the word discursive in a casual conversation. I believe he once told me happenstance was his favorite word. He was the president of his senior class and got a scholarship to attend Old Dominion University. And though they never told me how much, my family also let me know he spent some time in prison. I'd be a fool to believe that he was nothing but an ex-con, just as I'd be a fool to believe that of myself. I guess you could say that I am a romantic, or an idealist, or a fool, at least in the Whitmanian sense. I do believe I contain multitudes. I do believe this country does too. These days, I have become a man that weeps in public, and I think that is okay, because I have also become a man filled with joy and a man filled with hope for tomorrow and for today. It's wild. As a 16-year-old in prison, I wept because I believed I'd wasted my life. Today, I am the founder and CEO of Freedom Reads. We build freedom libraries, beautiful, handcrafted bookcases with a specially curated 500 book collection that includes Dr. King's letter from Birmingham jail and some Toni Morrison, some William Faulkner, and some Daniel Evans, amongst others. We place the Freedom Libraries in prisons across this country, in the cell blocks where people live. Our team includes the children of convicted felons, the children of police officers, those who have taught in prisons, those who have relatives in prison, and those who have never known prisons. And these descriptions are so limiting. Our motley group is America, and it makes me believe that this season is one when those in the beloved community keep reminding the world and each other what that means. I mean, isn't that the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.? And isn't it something lovely being able to demand justice in a loving way? The book that accompanies this article is Letter from Birmingham Jail by Martin Luther King Jr., afterword by Reginald Duane Betts. It's $18 at Amazon, $21 at bookshop.org, and $18 at Walmart. We're in wellness with this next article, The Hell of Hormonal Insomnia and How to Combat It. The authors of Menopause is Hot have advice to get you through the night. This article is by Marella Frotstrup and Alice Smelly. Menopause and lack of sleep are as closely intertwined as a pair of young lovers. There, of course, any similarity very much ends. In 2020, I wrote an article about what seemed to be an epidemic of sleeplessness, which appeared to affect women the most severely. Nothing I uncovered in the research process diminished my conviction that women in midlife struggle with one problem more than almost anything else: a lack of decent, restorative, regular sleep. To add insult to injury, it happens during a period when restorative anything is essential to everyday survival. So, what's keeping us awake during our menopausal years? First off, any temperature increase is likely to be thanks to night sweats. Your body perceives a rise in heat as being a threat. With your eyes closed, you don't know whether the house is on fire or if you're hot because of hormones. Therefore, our natural defense mechanism wakes us up, and for many of us, that's the end of it. We are also likely to have lower levels of progesterone. This hormone can make you feel sleepy by increasing production of GABA, G-A-B-A, a neurotransmitter or brain chemical that helps sleep and makes you feel more relaxed. The other reasons for poor sleep at this time of life are, as you'd expect, because of our day-to-day stresses. Not only are we busier than ever before, but the structure of the family has changed, and this has put more onus on women. Our guilt or overwork translates to stress and therefore sleeplessness. When this stress response is activated, and for whatever reason, it all cascades in the wrong direction, like a game of Jenga collapsing. In summary, if you suffer from insomnia, you may be fatter and more likely to get ill. Oh joy! Just a few years of insomnia can feel like a life sentence and culminate in ruined careers, relationships, and quality of life. But thankfully, there are solutions. Menopausal Hormone Therapy, MHT. MHT has been shown to help reduce night sweats, which are the whispering, fiery demons of the menopausal woman's night. Low estrogen is associated with less deep sleep, and progesterone helps you to relax and is known to increase the production of the brain chemical GABA, GABA. Low testosterone can also affect sleep. Lifestyle changes. Board-certified sleep and integrative medicine Dr. Valerie Cacho says that certain foods can be sleep-promoting. High-fiber foods promote low-wave sleep, whereas processed foods and saturated fats cause more arousal and light sleep. And exercise during the day helps you to sleep at night. Mind/body practices. Mindfulness, breathing exercises, meditation, and gratitude journaling can all be beneficial, says Cacho. That racing mind won't calm down because our sympathetic nervous system is working overtime. It's possible to learn how to strengthen the system and turn down the mind chatter in order to sleep. I've found that keeping a notepad by my bed to jot down the rare imperative chore or worthwhile inspiration I have in the early hours is also very helpful. Clinical hypnotherapy and acupuncture can also help alleviate hot flashes and improve sleep quality. Sleep clean. Experts are quite correct when they recommend that your room be as cool as possible and that you wear natural fibers to wick away moisture, as well as using cotton sheets. Don't do anything before bed to increase body temperature. Eating late, drinking too much alcohol, or doing vigorous exercise, although exercise during the day does help sleep quality. And we all know about leaving gadgets outside of the bedroom. Most importantly, go to bed and get up at the same time every day. This maintains your body clock. Bitter pill, melatonin. As day turns to night, the body produces melatonin as one of many signals that it's time to go to bed. People with heart problems, on beta blockers, and the elderly have lower levels of melatonin, and this may contribute to the poorer sleep seen in these groups of individuals. Although it's not a sleeping pill, many of us take melatonin to aid sleep, though sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Working it out, CBT. CBT, or cognitive behavioral therapy, is about reframing the fact that poor sleep is just a bad habit and learning what affects sleep. It's the frontline treatment for insomnia, and it's supported by the NHS, the EU, and the US. It's as good as, if not more effective, than sleeping pills. Naturally tired supplements. There is some evidence of efficacy for valerian, passionflower, and hops. Passion flower is said to reduce brain activity and help sleep. Valerian has sedative effects, but nobody seems quite sure why, though it's thought it might be related to GABA production as well. And hops also appear to affect melatonin and happy hormone serotonin. Dr. Cacho also recommends trying L-theanine, phytoestrogens, and chamomile. And the first one is spelled L-T-H-E-A-N-I-N-E. Phytoestrogens are P-H-Y-T-O-E-S-T-R-O-G-E-N-S. This is interesting because some research shows it can be helpful for general anxiety. There's also good evidence of magnesium's usefulness. It helps with leg cramps and muscle relaxation, and those who have trouble sleeping often have low levels of magnesium. Sleep apnea. For those with sleep apnea, sleeping on your side, weight loss, and what's called continuous positive airway, CPAP, therapy might all help, says Cacho. She also suggests that singing and playing wind instruments can help strengthen the muscles in the throat. Like so many aspects of our health, symptoms are subjective, and the solutions we're offering aren't universal cure-alls. For too long, we've simply shouldered the burden of our pesky biology and struggled on. But hopefully, better understanding the contributing factors to any struggles you might be having with sleep will open the doors to finding the right answers. There's a book that accompanies this article, Menopause is Hot by Mariella Frostrup, that's F-R-O-S-T-R-U-P, and Alice Smellie, S-M-E-L-L-I-E. The book is $23 at Amazon and $23 at Walmart. We're back over in wellness with We Asked Our Most Trusted Doctors About How to Find the Best Surgeons. Here's everything you need to know before you go under the knife. This article is by Eileen Weintraub. Research shows that 1 in 9 Americans have surgery in a given year. But just because it's common doesn't make going under the knife any less intimidating. Besides worrying about your health and the procedure itself, and now you have to scramble to find the best surgeon. It can feel impossible to know where to start. Who's the most qualified to do the kind of procedure you need? Which hospital near you is the best? And will they take your insurance? Many people trust their health to first provider they see, but that's not necessarily the best way to go. A 2017 study showed that patients have better quality of life and are more satisfied with their treatment when they have greater trust in their doctor. And a little bit of vetting before booking an appointment can go a long way toward establishing that trust. Here's how to find the right surgeon and how to advocate for your needs so you can get the care you deserve. Recommendations. Start your search by asking your current doctor for a recommendation. The physician who started the chain of events leading to your diagnosis has probably been down this road before, says Freya Schnabel, MD, that's spelled S-C-H-N-A-B-E-L, director of breast surgery at NYU Langone Health's Perlmutter Cancer Center in New York. They've likely had other patients with this diagnosis, and they tend to know local doctors in related specialties who can help, she says. It's also a good idea to tap your trusted circle of friends and family. The importance of word of mouth, personal connections, and family connections can't be overestimated, says Schnabel. Knowing that someone has had a good experience with a doctor is reassuring. In addition, reach out to any nurses or other healthcare professionals you may personally know, particularly if they work at the hospital where you're considering surgery. They know the inside scoop on who is trustworthy and has a good bedside manner, explains Marcus Thygeson, T-H-Y-G-E-S-O-N, MD, a patient advocate and the co-founder and CEO of the Parhesia Foundation, and that's spelled P-A-R-R-H-E-S-I-A. Once you have a few options to pursue, call your insurance company or log on to their website. It usually has a list of providers and can tell you who's in network. It may also have a bunch of hoops you'll need to jump through to secure coverage, such as getting a referral and getting pre-approval for scans and other tests, and there may be hidden out-of-pocket costs that could impact what you pay for surgery. Key stuff to know before scheduling a procedure. Vet their credentials and skills. A doctor's bio page, usually found on their hospital's website, can be helpful. Make sure the surgeon is certified by the American Board of Surgery, meaning the doctor has met specific standards of training and education for their field. This is usually denoted in the bio or can be verified through a simple Google search. If not, move on, says Thygesen. Next, look for the surgeon's areas of expertise to see if they have experience with your condition. If you're dealing with a diagnosis that's not terribly common, make sure the surgeon has a statement on their website stating that this is something they specifically treat, says Schnabel. The last thing you want to do is schedule an appointment with the wrong doctor. You can check out where they went to medical school, but a prestigious school is not always the best indicator of competence. Much more important is that they have the requisite training in the surgical field or subspecialty you need, says Thygesen. Don't worry about how old the surgeon is. Instead, choose one who is both experienced and open-minded. Schnabel says that the best combination is someone who has been doing this procedure for a long time, at least 5 years, suggests Thygesen, but also stays current with new developments and techniques. Expert surgeons are often active academically and have published papers in peer-reviewed journals about the type of surgery you are considering, Thygesen says. You can often find links to their papers on their bio page. Note how recent the studies are and if they mention the type of operation you're having. Read reviews wisely. When reading online reviews, remember that you're about to form a long-term relationship with that doctor. They'll perform your surgery and will see you for follow-ups in the coming weeks or months, depending on your medical issue. Read what people say about the surgeon's attitude, whether they appropriately address questions and concerns, and whether their office staff is responsive. Reputable places to look for reviews include LeapFrog, HealthGrades, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and U.S. News and World Report. It's also a good idea to read about the hospital to get a sense of its overall quality of care and make sure it has a good reputation. After all, Schnabel says, surgery is a team sport. You're going to have an anesthesiologist, several nurses, a pathologist, and many other people involved in your care. However, Schnabel recommends being wary of one-off patient reviews. You don't know if it's a singular situation or a repetitive pattern, so don't focus on one review. Get the overall picture, she says. Make your consultation count. Educate yourself about your condition and its treatments, including surgery, but don't believe everything you read on Google. Instead, focus on reputable sites, such as foundations that deal with your specific diagnosis. For example, if you want to learn more about breast cancer, check out the American Cancer Society or the National Breast Cancer Foundation. Doctors can tell when you've done your homework. Thygesen suggests bringing prior medical records and test results, say a copy of your most recent MRI, or making sure they're available through your health care provider's online portal so the surgeon can review them beforehand. Give the provider a list of your current medications and supplements. It's surprising how many people don't know their medications or their dosages, says Schnabel. But surgeons need this information to make sure there are no drug interactions with future treatment. If possible, have a friend or family member accompany you to take notes. Having someone else present is very important, Schnabel adds. Whether that's a spouse, a partner, a good friend, or just someone who is less emotionally involved with the situation. What to ask? Many patients are surprised when a complication occurs or the recovery is much slower than they expected, Thygesen says. He recommends making a list of questions to help you better understand how the procedure will impact you. These are good starting points. How often do you do the surgery? Do I really need the surgery, or could I treat my condition in another way? What outcomes of surgery can I realistically expect for my age and health? What will recovery look like? What level of activity will I be able to return to after surgery? How likely are the complications, and how might they affect me? If there's something you don't understand, ask for clarification. Thygesen also suggests telling the surgeon what your goals are for the surgery and the type and amount of activity you hope to resume, as well as sharing any concerns you have about complications and recovery time. In general, surgeons are likely to give you an optimistic expectation, Thygesen adds. So, unless your doctor notes that the recovery time they're giving you is an average or range, for example, assume that number is the best possible outcome. Don't talk to only one provider before scheduling your procedure. Get second and third opinions to ensure you're receiving the proper treatment, suggests Schnabel. Unfortunately, you can't control everything about big health issues, including surgeries. But doing some research, asking questions, and communicating your needs can help you feel better about what's ahead. Working with a doctor of any kind is like having a relationship, says Schnabel, and ongoing relationships have to have reasonable ground rules. We're on the word of the week. This is in the wholeness section. Midlife chrysalis. You won't need to buy a sports car after this transformation. This article is by Cassie Hurwitz. Midlife chrysalis. Turning 45 or 50 might raise a battery of existential questions. Am I happy? What am I doing with my life? Is this menopause? But according to Chip Conley, author of Learning to Love Midlife, this period doesn't have to be a crisis. Instead, midlife can be a transformational moment for us all, Conley says. Just as the butterfly emerges from its cocoon, the midlife chrysalis allows the 40 and up set a space to reevaluate their dreams in order to find more happiness and purpose, the ultimate glow up. To honor the midlife chrysalis, Conley created the Modern Elder Academy, MEA, a school dedicated to helping older adults envision their next chapter or act. MEA offers virtual courses and IRL workshops in Baja, Mexico, and Santa Fe, New Mexico, focusing on passion, purpose, friendship, and longevity in your 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond. Going the DIY route on your midlife rebrand? Oprah's The Life You Want, Finding Your Purpose journal features 12 chapters of questions, quotes, and prompts to help you find renewed purpose. Our potential class is also chock full of ways to find passion. At the very least, 40 and 50-somethings should take heart. The midlife crisis is averted. It might even be converted. We're over in relationships. The most romantic thing I've ever experienced. Oprah Daily Insiders share gestures, small and large, that have made them feel loved. This article is by Cassie Hurwitz. Breakfast in bed, love notes, surprise trips to Paris. When it comes to romantic gestures, a girl can dream, right? Or, as in the case of our Oprah Daily Insiders, a girl can just find herself an incredible partner who shows up every day in ways big, both big and small. When we asked insiders for the most romantic thing they'd ever experienced, they really delivered. At least their loved ones did. From Friday flowers to morning coffee to mountains of rice, no really, these acts of love could fill a giant heart-shaped bathtub. A boyfriend once left a bouquet of sunflowers on my desk at work for no special reason other than he was thinking of me and wanted to brighten my day. No call or text. I just returned to my desk to a bouquet of sunshine. I loved the spontaneous randomness of it. Kathy Halaski. The most romantic thing he does is write beautiful songs, and I am his muse. It's an unmatched feeling of love. Taz Walker. The most romantic moment in my life was 24 years ago. I was at work, and suddenly the owner of the nearby smoothie restaurant delivered my favorite juice, Jugo de Guanabana, to my office, of course. I thought it was a mistake because I didn't order it. At that time, I was just a student doing an internship. And after telling the owner I didn't order the juice, he responded, "This is for you. You will be receiving your favorite juice every morning until the end of your internship. Your friend already paid for all of the deliveries." My friend, Jose, had finished his internship and left the day before, but knew exactly how much I enjoyed that specific juice and wanted to make sure I remembered him. Every time I think about that moment, I feel the joy I had, the love of my friend, and my big smile. A big smile that comes back today while having this memory. Alba Thomason. One Valentine's Day, I had the worst stomach virus. I didn't know what day it was and was so dehydrated that I had to go to the hospital. Afterward, the doctor advised my husband to introduce food to me slowly. Clean chicken, white rice, crackers, Gatorade. I could consume an ounce or two of something, but no more. We returned home and I slept the rest of the day. When I woke up, I entered my kitchen to find 12 whole chickens, a mountain of white rice, 15 boxes of crackers, and 48 bottles of Gatorade. That expression of love is something that remained deep in my heart for decades. When I'm most frustrated with him, I see a parade of chickens and a mountain of rice. Denise Scuderi. That's S-C-U-D-E-R-I. My husband, Mark, and I have been married for 41 years. One of the romantic things he does for me now is he buys me coffee every morning at McDonald's. That kindness tells me that he thought about me before he went to work. Susie Angulo, A-N-G-U-L-O. My husband and I are not conventionally romantic. But then again, if I define romance as offering unconditional, unwavering support for me to go off and pursue my dreams, then my husband of 35 years is very romantic. When I left behind a reliable salary 5 years ago, he readily agreed to support me in every possible way, financially and emotionally. Without his love and support, I would never have been able to pursue and achieve so many of my creative dreams. Amy L. Bernstein. A few months ago, I fell down the stairs and broke my ankle in 3 places. I was basically stuck in bed for 6 weeks. My husband took over everything that I normally do for my family, plus he took care of me nonstop. I can't express how thankful I am for the love he showed me and the mental respite he afforded me. Annette Rogers. I had done one of those silly get-to-know-you quizzes on Facebook, and in answer to the question, "What are you most afraid of?" I wrote, "Losing my mother." My mom commented on that post unexpectedly with a beautiful message about how she will always be with me. For my first birthday with him, my then boyfriend, now husband, framed a photo of me and my mom and had her comment printed on the photo. It was the most thoughtful gift I've ever received. Katrina Koenig. Whenever I was stressed or worried or having a bad day, my husband would always find my car and leave flowers and a sweet note to encourage me. We would also have date nights twice a month, no matter how tired he was. He always put our love and marriage first. He passed away from COVID, but his love still lives in me. I miss him so much. Sylvia Williams. In my West African heritage, cooking is usually the woman's forte, and they say the way into a man's heart is through his stomach. When my date cooked me the most complex meal that I would not dare attempt if I wished to impress someone, I was so moved and felt pampered. Anita Ansa. My husband and I have started a ritual that keeps the spark alive. Bathroom mirror messages. Each day we leave little notes to each other on his and her sides of the mirror. They're short, sweet, and filled with love and humor. Things like, "Three of our family," or "You make it a great day." These messages aren't extravagant, but they're constant reminders of how much we mean to each other. This simple daily act has become our version of romance, a way to celebrate each other even on the busiest days. Sometimes love doesn't need grand gestures. It's about those tiny moments that make you smile, knowing someone sees and appreciates the real you. Amy Boyle. I got married for the first time at 56. While our relationship has had its growing pains, I could not imagine life without him. One of the most romantic things he does for me is Friday flowers. We started dating in 2019, then the pandemic hit, and after isolating and sheltering in place every other week, he would buy me flowers on Fridays when he came to visit. He was in Santa Clara, California, and I was in Oakland. When we got married, he continued the tradition. To this day, I get fresh Friday flowers from the local woman-owned flower shop in Sonoma, California, where we live now. I try really hard not to expect Friday flowers every week, but they almost always show up on Fridays. I keep all of the little notes that come with the flowers to remind me of how loved and appreciated my husband makes me feel. Joan R. Stayed up late after a big party, cleaned and put everything away without being asked, and was genuinely happy I got to sleep in and enjoy some well-deserved rest. Darlene Fuchs. Asking me to renew our wedding vows twice in 37 years. Karen A. My husband, Javon, and I have been married for 13 years. We have a 9-year-old that we struggled to conceive. The most romantic Valentine's Day moments, being sent flowers and Sherry's berries at work, and sharing our first Valentine's Day with our little girl, Nadia Grace, which means hope and gift from God, Samantha Fitz. The most wonderful act of true love is the continuous love that I show for myself. Exercise, cooking, healthy meals, reading a good book, listening to a podcast, revisiting Luther Vandross's music, nurturing my creativity, managing my finances, learning to appreciate the peace within, and exploring the beauty of my natural hair. Irma Bryant. Over in lifestyle and food, 9 foods that fight inflammation, as if you needed one more excuse to drink coffee. This article is by Perry O. Bloomberg. By eating inflammation-fighting foods, not only can you boost your immune system, says nutritionist Amy Shapiro, MSRD nutrition advisor for Daily Harvest, but you'll also fill up on antioxidants, fiber, vitamins, and other good-for-you compounds. Whether you're craving something sweet, a few decadent squares of dark chocolate or blueberries, anyone? Or savory, like guacamole and stir-fried mushrooms. These anti-inflammatory foods will make a meal come to life with delicious flavor. Number 1, dark chocolate. Treating yourself to dark chocolate may make more than your taste buds happy. A recent clinical trial found that eating about 2 ounces of dark chocolate 2 hours before a socially stressful situation blunted the stress-induced inflammatory response, explains nutritionist Maggie Moon, MSRD, and author of The Mind Diet. Moon recommends buying a bar that's at least 70% dark chocolate. Number 2. Garlic. The pungent herb is well worth incorporating into as many meals as possible. Garlic contains prebiotics, a type of fiber that fuels the good bacteria in your digestive system. Prebiotics could help lower your risk of colon cancer and support a healthy immune system, says Christy Brissett, MSRD of 8020 Nutrition in Chicago. Prebiotics, along with probiotics, the good bacteria found in foods such as kimchi, sauerkraut, and kefir, may help with inflammatory conditions such as irritable bowel syndrome and ulcerative colitis, she adds. Bonus, garlic also has a compound in it called allicin, that's A-L-L-I-C-I-N, which offers antibacterial properties. It's been used for centuries by many cultures as an immune system booster. One study found that eating raw crushed garlic increased the function of 7 genes associated with immune health, adds Brissett. Number 3. Blueberries. Blueberries are a good source of vitamin C, an antioxidant that protects your cells from free radical damage and helps your immune system work properly, says Brissett. In terms of inflammation, the berry is also awesome. One study found that consuming less than 1/4 cup of blueberry juice, along with medication, may help improve markers of inflammation and ease symptoms and side effects in an inflammatory disease called juvenile idiopathic arthritis, Brissett explains. Number 4. Almonds. Almonds contain the ideal balance of protein, fiber, and are rich in healthy fats that'll provide you with slow, sustained energy. They're also an excellent source of vitamin E, containing more than other nuts per ounce, says Brissett. Vitamin E is a powerful antioxidant that may help to lower inflammation. Additionally, research indicates that eating 1.5 ounces of nuts daily as part of a heart-healthy diet may help lower the risk of heart disease. Number 5. Avocados. The mighty avocado can help crush headaches and jazz up a sad salad, but it's also an important part of an anti-inflammatory diet. Over 75% of the fats in avocados are heart-healthy unsaturated fats, says Brissett. In a recent study in overweight and obese adults, eating a meal that contained half or a whole avocado improved markers of heart health and inflammation compared to a low-fat, high-carb meal with the same amount of calories. Avocados are also a good source of fiber. One serving, a third of an avocado, has about 3 grams of fiber, which will keep hunger in check. Number 6. Coffee. There's a micronutrient in coffee called chlorogenic acid that research suggests fights inflammation in the gut by suppressing oxidation and inflammatory markers in intestinal cells, explains Moon. Studies show the health benefits of a coffee habit come with 3 to 4 cups a day. To keep your cup a nutritional powerhouse, try a non-dairy milk like almond or coconut and forgo sugary or any artificial sweeteners. Number 7. Mushrooms. All mushrooms, button, shiitake, portobello, contain polysaccharides, compounds with anti-inflammatory properties, says Andy Bellotti, a Las Vegas-based dietitian. Mushrooms have beta-glucans, a special type of glucose that has been shown to reduce inflammation, he continues. We're particularly fond of sautéing portobellos in a little olive oil and serving them on buns with a slew of toppings like caramelized onions, pickles, and avocado slices for burger night. Or add smaller varieties like shiitake, button, or cremini to your next stir-fry. Number 8. Turmeric. This knobby root with bright orange flesh is a boon for your health thanks to curcumin, its active ingredient that makes turmeric anti-inflammatory, notes Shapiro. In some cultures, turmeric is plentiful. However, most of us don't know how to incorporate it, says Shapiro, who loves adding the potent plant to lattes or broth. You can also try adding the dried spice to homemade veggie chili or flipping a teaspoon or two into a pre-workout smoothie. Number 9. Hemp seeds. Hemp seeds contain gamma-linolenic acid, the only omega-6 fatty acid known to have anti-inflammatory effects, says Bellotti. Typically, omega-6 fatty acids are pro-inflammatory, while omega-3 fatty acids fight inflammation. The fact that hemp seeds contain this unique omega-6 fatty acid, as well as omega-3 fatty acids, makes them anti-inflammatory all-stars. Sprinkle a generous amount over oatmeal, add them to smoothies, or stir them into your go-to vinaigrette recipe. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time.